week, deep waters in which to swim. Week 62. Chapter 40, sentence 25. No danger of drowning, the Leviathan will catch you. Nothing to be concerned about on that front.
Which page?
It is, if you're using the Art Scroll Tanakh, page 1675. 16. You're close, though. 1575 may be a little more joyful. Probably somewhere in Tehillim, if I had to guess. Put it 100 pages earlier. Pretty good odds. Yeah, 1575 would already be Proverbs. Never mind. Okay. So, we are in the second speech that God offers to Job, the one that is louder and slower than the first one, in which he says to Job again, how about you try to run the world? And then he introduces him to two beasts. So last time we had Behemoth as the first beast, and this time we have Leviathan, the Leviathan. And we asked the question last time of whether these are meant to be real creatures or not. We noted the commentators who do associate Behemoth with a buffalo. Oh, not a buffalo, sorry, hippopotamus. There also are those who associate it with some form of an ox, which I didn't really know, but we're going to come across that this week. And then the Leviathan is associated with crocodile, alligator, fearsome sea creature, which we're going to talk about this week. And then, of course, we saw also the view of Maharal and others that said, no, this is actually meant to be non-literal. It's metaphorical. It's referring to, instead, something related to future in the next world and metaphysical concepts rather than, you know, real-life creatures. So we did Behemoth last time, and Behemoth is really just the warm-up, it looks like, in this book, in the sense that when he actually got around to talking about Behemoth, it was from sentence 15 through sentence 24. He got 10 sentences. Whereas when we deal with Leviathan, you're going to see that it's going to be the whole rest of chapter 40 as well as all of chapter 41. Leviathan seems to be the main attraction here. So what is the Leviathan? As I said, usually rendered if it is a natural beast, as a crocodile or an alligator, because you see descriptions of its strong hide, its scales, its teeth. I will note that the Malbim, on another appearance of Leviathan in Tehillim in Psalms, it's in Psalms 104:26. We're going to come back to that verse at some point. So there, Malbim renders it as whalefish. Now, whales aren't fish, and neither of them are Leviathan. Nonetheless, that's the term. I don't know what he means when he uses the term whalefish. I sense that I would need to know, you know, Yiddish or something else that's Eastern European in nature in order to know what he's talking about when he says whalefish. Malbim, I believe, is Czech. Maybe it's meant to be something unreal. Yeah, and that entirely is possible. I mean, one of the real problems about it, which we're going to have to address, is that there's a section in this description where it sounds like it's a fire-breathing dragon. So we're going to have to come back to that. I don't know of sea-dwelling, fire-breathing dragons, but, you know, then again, there's an awful lot I don't know in the realm of fire-breathing dragons. So, you know, I guess it could be. It's going to continue the theme established with the lesser animals we discussed in the previous speech, as well as with Behemoth, and we saw it in Rambam and Moreh Nevuchim, which is, this is a world you don't understand, Job, and in which you have no control. And that's what very much the theme you're going to see here. So let's take a look. Chapter 40, sentence 25, once again, page 1675 in the Stone Tanakh, where he turns to Job and says, tell me something, this Leviathan, this Leviathan, could you catch, kill, and butcher this creature? That's the question. Sentence 25. Timshoch Leviathan bechaka uvechevel tashkia leshono. Could you draw the Leviathan, the Leviathan, with a hook? Chaka is a term that we use for a hook, like you would use when you go fishing. Could you sink a rope into its tongue? That's the usual rendering of this sentence. Hashkia, lahashkia, is to sink into something. Could you sink a rope into its tongue? Alternatively, Ralbag says, could you lure it with a hook that you sink into the water? Another approach, same fundamental idea. Hatasim agmon be'apo uvechoach tikov lechio. Could you place an agmon into its nostril? So agmon we usually render as a reed. Halachov ka'agmon rosho, Yeshaya says in the Haftarah of Yom Kippur. Well, Yeshaya said it before it was a Haftarah for Yom Kippur, but you know what I mean. But he describes somebody bending his head humbly like an agmon, like a reed. So the way that it's taken here is either to say, as Rashi does, that it's a curved hook, or, as others say, it's like it's cane. So that it has that plant growth aspect of being like a reed, but it's something to draw the animal forward, clearly. In other words, you have tamed this beast. So can you put the agmon through its nostrils? Uvechoach tikov lechayo. And with a choach is a thorn, right? The chochim, kishoshana bein hachochim. So with a thorn, could you puncture its jaw? That's the image that is offered, again, all about taming the animal, such that, if you look at Pasuk Chav Zayin, sentence 27, Hayarbe elecha tachanunim amidaber elecha rakot, will it increase its pleas to you? In other words, you've now brought it under control, you've tamed it, so now it's going to plead with you, let me go. Amidaber elecha rakot, will it speak softly to you? I was waiting for some kind of a reference to crocodile tears in here, but there is none. But will it plead with you to let it go? Hayichros bris imach, pasuk chaches, sentence 28. Will it cut a deal with you? Tikachenu le'eved olam, where you could take it to be your slave forever. Can you tame the Leviathan? Can you bring it under your control? And then we get a very interesting sentence. This sentence is worth, even in a week when we're rushing, because we really want to make sure to be able to spend time on the last chapter. Nonetheless, you got to spend time on this sentence. Hasisachek bo katzipor. Will you play with the Leviathan as with a bird? Visikshirenu lenaro secha. Will you tie it for your young girls as a toy? In other words, can you turn this into a pet that you can play with, that the girls can play with? What is this image of playing with it as a bird? What is that meant to convey? What does it show if you can play with it like a bird?
Tame.
It's no threat.
Is it only taming?
Controlling.
I think it's stronger than
trusting it to not hurt you.
Well, either that or you have it under such control that it doesn't dare, or it's,
but,
you know, has no power over you.
What happens if you reduced it?
Yes, I think I would use the same term that you use, but slightly differently. I think that it is an element of diminution, but not diminution physically, as much as there's a difference between, let's say you tamed a bronco, okay? You tamed this wild horse, so you control it. But you don't take it lightly. You don't play games with the bronco. The day that you get on the bronco and you're not careful is the day you get thrown off. Right? That's the danger. The image of playing with it is you have no fear that it's going to be able to do anything to you anymore. It is a total state of control. That's the image. It's stronger than just having tamed it. Now, a couple of points on this. First of all, this changes the image, because the previous sentences talked about luring it into a trap and enslaving it. Now it's about playing with it. So Mitzudat David alters this. If you take a look at source number one, Mitzudat David takes it within the image of trapping. He says, "V'chi salig bo kasher talig b'tzipor." Will you mock it as you would mock a bird? Asher titela fanav garinei tvuah lapach, where you put down these grains leading to the trap. V'hu yared b'le'achol v'nalkad sham, and then it goes to eat, and it gets caught in the trap. In other words, it's part of the image of trapping it. Playing with it as you play with a bird means that you're able to trap it easily in the way that you trap a bird. That's mitzudat David. I think that's a simple read of the sentence. But you have to go further with this. As an aside, I thought there was another possible reference if you read the sentence differently, but I couldn't find anybody who actually took it this way. You must have learned about it at some point or seen a documentary at some point about the different symbiotic relationships that exist in the animal kingdom. So which one is it that the crocodile has? No, they're not symbiotic. The birds, the plover birds, right? Plovers have a symbiotic relationship with the crocodiles, and they live on top of the crocodile, and they're not afraid of anything. So I wondered if it couldn't be, Hasisachek Bo, can you play with it, Kasipur, the way a bird plays with it? You know, are you comfortable with it? But I couldn't find anybody who said that. So maybe they're not up on National Geographic. I don't know.
Sure.
Yeah.
It sounds to me like what God is doing to Job. Like,
playing with
it. Total control. There's nothing I can't do to you. Nothing.
Interesting.
And we have done all those things too.
Interesting. The only catch that I see in that is that he never turns around and says that.
Well, in other words, God.
In other words, God does say to him, do you control it in this way? He does have this explicit layer. Yeah. And I sort of feel like if he also wanted to say, by the way, that's the way I control you.
So there has to be a closing statement.
I would think so. In the same way that I wanted to suggest when we saw the general animals before, I wanted to suggest that there was a statement to Job of, you know, I deal with the animal kingdom and I take care of them and I don't talk to them. I take care of you. Don't expect me to talk to you either. But again, God never closed the loop on that. The sentence wasn't there for me to feel like that was really there as a message.
Because I don't have to explain anything to you. I am that I am. So I don't know. Let's see.
But it's a funny thing, because generally when God says that, he says that. Do you know what I mean? There's usually a sentence of, I don't need to explain anything, and I'm explaining now that I don't need to explain anything.
I know very little, so that's just my first
impression. I don't know. It's a valid point. The question is simply, is this what we're trying to communicate here? Rochelle, you out of here?
No.
Okay. Ralph.
Is it a metaphor for, you think you won't control God? You can't control.
Well, not so much about controlling God, but you think that there's some basis for communication between us. Look around you, Job. Recognize how little you know of and understand and control of this world. And we're going to see more about that because Newsom, as her usual, has a good way of summing up this idea, which we're going to hopefully get to. But there is another layer here. And this is what I meant, Susan.
We're talking about God's greatness, and God is telling him he doesn't understand anything. But God, it's like a kid, when you ask them a question, they don't want to answer it. They just talk about something else. It's as if Job had a specific question. And God's not, he's giving you all sorts of his mighty powers and everything. Now, I suppose you could say he's answering by saying, you won't understand my answer. But he's not going to wait. Job went through all this.
So 2 points. Point number one is that God doesn't spend any time really talking about his mighty power. Think back over the two speeches we've read. God spends very little time talking about himself. He spends a lot of time talking about the wonders of this chaotic world of wild animals. If God wants to talk about himself, he tends to do so directly. It's much more about what human beings don't do. He did a little bit. Like, he talked about taking care of the babies of the wild antelope, deer, whatever that was, wild goat. But really, the emphasis is much more on what Job doesn't know and doesn't do than it is about what God does. This isn't a self-aggrandizing speech about, look how wonderful I am. In terms of in terms of what you're saying, I think that the point really is the statement of, Job, there's so much more in this world than you comprehend. You can't create what Newsom calls a spectrum in which sort of you're here on the spectrum and I'm here on the spectrum and therefore we have a means of communication. There is no spectrum, Job. We deal with things on entirely different planes, and that's what I'm trying to get across. And you're right. I'm not going to answer your question. I'm just not going to. But I want to go further, Ralph. I'm sorry. There's so much here that has to be said. I'm going to ask you to wait with it to the end. Fair? well, not necessarily fair, but I apologize. I just, there's so much here to see that if we go round and round on justice, we'll never get through it. But I wanted you to see this other layer, because it's a very important layer within Midrash on this. I referenced on your sheet at number 2, a verse that I already mentioned, Psalms chapter 104, sentence 26. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, you want page 1527. The psalm is known in Hebrew as Barchi Nafshi, this beautiful song about nature. An interesting contrast between this song about nature and the song you see in Job about nature. Very different depictions. I think we mentioned it last week or the week before. But I'm zeroing in on sentences 25, 26, where he turns to the sea. And he says, Zayam gadol rechav yadayim. This great sea, it is so large. Sham remes v'ein mispar. You have innumerable crawling creatures. Chayos kitanos im gedolos. Small creatures and big creatures. And then sentence 26, Sham aniyos ya'alechun. Boats travel there. Livyasan ze yatzarta l'sachek bo. The Leviathan that you created, l'sachek bo. So if I were to read this sentence without benefit of the English translation, I might be tempted to translate l'sachek bo as you created the Leviathan to play in it, to play within the sea. This is the sea where boats travel. This is the sea where there are small creatures and big creatures. And you create the Leviathan to play in the sea, is frankly the way I would have rendered it. The Midrash does not do so. Take a look, please, at source number 3. Here's a blow-your-mind source if you've ever seen one. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda said, quoting Rav, Shtemes reishos havi hayom. Daytime is 12 hours, meaning you can divide up daylight into 12 periods. Each one will call 1 hour. Not suggesting 60-minute hours. That's not the point. Shalosh harishonos, for the first 3 hours, HaKadosh Baruch Hu yoshev va'osek batorah. God sits and studies Torah. That's good. That's the way you should start your day. Shnios yoshev v'danas kol ha'olam kulo. The next set of 3 hours, he judges the world. Kevin Sharosh nischayev olam kliya, or klaya, when he sees, people are guilty, the world should be destroyed. Ome mikise adin v'yoshev akise rahim. He shifts over to the merciful side and says, well, I'm not going to do it. Shlishios, the third set of hours, yoshev v'zanes kala olam kulo mikarnei re'imim ad beitzekinim. He sits and he judges the entire world from great to small, from the horns of the re'im, which is supposed to be a very large creature, all the way down to the lice eggs.
Okay. Judges or feeds?
I'm sorry, did I say judges? Yeah. Feeds. Revios yoshev umesachek im livyasan. And then for the last set in the evening, it's been a long day, so he sits and plays with the Leviathan, and they quote the verse that we just read from Psalms. Livyasan is ze yatzarta lesachek bo. You created the Leviathan to play with it. In other words, it's God's toy. So they didn't render it as you created Leviathan to play in the sea, but rather you created the Leviathan in order for you to play with it. What's the idea? Why do they translate the sentence that way? Forget entirely the discussion of what's going on in each of the 3 hours of the day, because I don't know. I don't understand it. Maybe one day we'll come to some kind of comprehension of it, and we can spend a year on this passage. There's an awful lot to be said about what in the world this is talking about. But I want to focus on what they just did with the Leviathan, translating it as you created Leviathan as a toy to play with. Why does the Gemara there, why does the Talmud there translate this passage from Tehillim, from Psalms, to say the Leviathan is God's toy instead of Leviathan plays in the sea? Yes?
What is overwhelmingly large and powerful to you is a mere plaything to God.
True, but it doesn't explain why we would read the sentence in Psalms that way. Psalms isn't talking at all about God in that sense. Yeah?
Well, I don't know, isn't it sort of a subject? you know, look at this great sea, you know, how large it is, and boats are in it, and it's also there for your not just the work that you do, Hashem, but also your rest time, or whatever downtime, the play.
Whatever that means.
Right. to play with the creatures in it, the large creature in it.
But what would put that in my head to read it as though God has playtime? In other words, hey, I never read this Gemara. Had you just asked me, what's God's policy on recreation, right, without this passage from the Talmud, I probably would have expected that, no, there's no such thing as downtime for God. Because why does God need downtime?
But there is a reference to play in the book of Job. Play with the bird.
Bingo. Joyce just got it. The sentence, what the Gemara is doing, what the Talmud is doing here, is something we talked about endlessly when we did Midrash as a subject a couple of years ago. And we said that you have to remember when you read Midrash that it's not only using the sentence that you see in front of you in the text, it is always, not always, but it is very often drawing on biblical texts that it doesn't bother to quote, but that definitely inform its read of what's in front of it. And that's exactly what's going on here. The reason it renders Psalms as saying that God plays with Leviathan is because in Job, God speaks of playing with the Leviathan. Hatesachek bo, will you play with it as one plays with a bird? So I think that's what leads Avodah Zarah, the Gemara here, to read it this way. Now, what is the image of playing with the Leviathan? So Maharal, as could be expected, renders this all mystically. He says this is not something that you're meant to take literally. It's all layers and layers of mysticism, which he spends quite a bit of time trying to explain. I saw an idea from somebody that I thought was interesting, although I don't think it really fits, but I mentioned it because it was interesting, that there was a god in the ancient Near East called Lotan. And that maybe this is a play on that with Leviathan, that God treats Lotan like a plaything, so to speak. The weakness of it is, among other things, that Lotan would be spelled with a tet, I believe, not with a tuf. I think the spelling is wrong. And also, it would fit not at all in the context here. There was no discussion here about other gods whatsoever. To suddenly think that God is throwing this in a speech to Job, I think is to ignore the context in a way that you can't really do. So I don't think that that's the explanation. But I think what is going on is, indeed, this statement of, this is just a plaything to God. This Leviathan, which is so frightening, and we're going to read about how frightening it is just a toy to you. Ralph, you were going to say?
The Leviathan is not a worldly creature. It is something far removed from it.
Maybe.
Imaginary or mystical or whatever it is. If that's the level that God is operating on, and this creature is on the same level.
Or at least it's something which only someone on that level is able to handle, potentially. So he says to Job, can you tame it? Can you play with it? Can you trap it? And then finally, the next step, unfortunately, Pasuk Lamed, sentence 30, we're back in Job once again. We're on page 1675. Yichru alav chabarim, yechitzuhu bein knanim. So there are a couple of different ways to read this line. One approach is, yichru alav, lichrod, with this chav, can be to arrange a sale. So yichru alav chabarim suggests groups of merchants setting prices for the meat. Once you butcher the Leviathan, yechetzu bein Knaanim, they will split it up among Knaanim, a Knaani being a merchant, not a Knaanite. But as is found in a couple of places in Tanakh, Velo Yavo Knaani Od, I think is at the end of Zechariah, the image of Knaani is a merchant. So that's one approach. An alternative approach is, as Rashi reads it, yichru alav chabarim, like chover chaver. They are sorcerers, people who try to enchant animals. So, charmers, that's the word I wanted. So, yichru alav chabarim, that you're going to gather the snake charmers, and they're going to charm the Leviathan, and then they'll divide it up among the merchants. Yeah, good luck. But that's Pasuk Lamed, sentence 30. And then in sentence 31, Hatmalei Bisukot Oro, Uvitzil Tzal Dagim Rosho. So again, there are a couple of different ways that you can translate this. Some, like Mitsudata David, render it as, will you use blades to cut its skin? Sukkot being a sharp-edged item, a blade. Will you use blades to cut its skin? Will you hit it on the head with its tzilsal, which they explain as a tool used to club fish? However, Rashi does not take it this way. And, in fact, the passage in the Talmud that we're going to see does not take it this way either. Take a look, please, at source number 4. It's an important read. How else could I render the word sukkah, if not as a sharp object?
Sukkah.
A sukkah, a hut. One of the people who's following this class online mentioned to me the possibility of making associations between the Leviathan of Iyov and the fish of Yonah. Now, Leviathan is not called a dog, it's not called a fish. But if you wanted to make associations, of course, Yonah at the end of the book makes a sukkah. And here you go, Hatmale bisukot oro, as Rashi reads it, in source number 4. Will you fill your desire, Hatmale tabatcha v'taaseh sukkot me oro? Will you make huts with the hide of this creature? So can you butcher the creature and make use of it? Make use of the flesh, make use of the skin.
Conquer.
Well, not just conquer, but destroy, effectively. Yeah. So God says to him, Job, if you're able to do that, I'll take my hat off to you. He says, Pasuk Lamed Bet, sentence 32. Sim alav kapecha, Job. Put your hand upon this Leviathan. Zechor milchama al tosaf. I'm pretty sure you're going to forget about fighting with it at that point. Once you try putting your hand on the Leviathan, all thoughts of doing battle with it, demonstrating your dominance over it, are going to come to an end. We jump into chapter 41. Hei netochal to nechzava. His hope, the hope of anybody to conquer the Leviathan, will be disappointed. Hagam el marav yutal. Just by looking at it, the person who would hunt it will be laid out flat. Lo achzar ki urenu. Nobody is tough enough or cruel enough against himself, as another reason, to awaken this Leviathan. Umihu lefana yityatzav. And this clause is a very difficult one to translate, and those who are looking at multiple translations will be able to tell just how difficult this is to translate, because God inserts himself here, where he hasn't really been a party to this conversation, so to speak. God wasn't a subject before. He didn't talk about himself. So this is very difficult to read, this sentence, and really the next sentence as well. So one way to read this, Mitzudat David says, this is God saying, I do these things to the Leviathan. As we talked about already last week, and we're going to see hopefully at the end this week, this image of God butchering the Leviathan as a reward for the righteous in the future. This is something that I do. So is there anybody who is able to do this as I can? Meaning, you claim that you deserve reward. If I wanted to reward you, nobody could stop me. Even the Leviathan can't stand in my way. How much more so, nobody else would be able to stop me from doing it. That's the read of Mitzudat David. Who could possibly do this faster than me? Who could? Clearly, if I felt you deserved a reward, I would give it to you. And he says, Mi hikdimani va'ashalem. Who would do this to the Leviathan faster than me? And again, I would reward him, or I would reward you. Tachas kol hashamayim lihu. Everything under the heavens belongs to me. It's a very awkward translation. It's a very tough read. If you take a look at the stone in the art scroll, they read it differently. No person is rash enough to stir him up. Who then would dare stand up to me? Whoever anticipated me, meaning will do this before I do it, I can reward him, for whatever is under all the heavens is mine. Meaning I would reward anybody who could actually do this to the Leviathan. Still very hard to read, very hard to fit into the sentences and into the rest of the speech. Susan.
But if the Leviathan is the crocodile.
Yeah.
Well, we have painted, well, we've gotten it skinned, it's been made into all sorts of things. So, I don't think the Leviathan has to be an extinct or an animal. It can't be the crocodile.
Right.
The crocodile, you know, the crocodile can be used, and it has been killed, and it's skin has been used, so it's contradictory.
Right. Well, three possibilities. Possibility number one is simply to say, yeah, this is something supernatural. Possibility number two is that this is meant to be a super form of a creature that he is aware of, just, you know, amplified.
Sure.
Yeah. There's this granddaddy of the crocodiles around. This isn't like the crocodiles you've seen, you know, it's not on that scale. But a third possibility is that we have these things called guns, which Job does not have. And the idea of hunting a crocodile by hand with a knife.
That's what Superman does.
Yeah. I rest my case.
That's the level you're working
at. Right. I don't know at what stage in human history people started to be able to capture live crocodiles. You can make something out of the dead ones. But making something out of the live ones, taming a live croc? Well, taming was in this mix also, you know. But they're fast. I don't know how you bop one on the head with a rock. Crocodiles are fast. And if you're close enough to bop it on the head, I hate to tell you, you aren't going to be holding the rock for a long time. Debbie.
But it's just metaphor.
Yeah, why is
that
it,
could be.
Why does it matter what it is? That it is what's important.
To some people.
This isn't parable.
To some people.
That's
clearly not to Susan. Clearly not to Susan. But yes, I think,
yeah,
you know.
I'm sorry.
No, she said just say it's a metaphor and be done with it.
Oh.
And you could. But not everybody likes to read it as a metaphor. Okay. The text is here in front of us for us to wrestle with. It is its own Leviathan.
Seems to me that it's a metaphor that Job or a human being can relate to. Because you have no way of understanding what God is,
right,
what his nature is. So a Leviathan is a representative of something that is beyond your power.
Right, and it could be. He's framing it in terms of a creature Job would have some familiarity with to give him that association. Entirely reasonable. So now, after saying nobody can do this, nobody is capable of conquering it, and I would honor anybody who was capable of doing so, and he says in sentence 4, actually completing this subsection, Lo acharish badav, I would not be silent before him. Udvar givuros v'chin erko, the word of his might, and his level, chin is charm often, and chin is the way they render it in the Da'at Mikra. But his great level, his value, this person who would do this, you know why? Because here I'm about to tell you all about this Leviathan. And now we're going to get the description of what exactly the Leviathan's traits are. Pasuk Hey, sentence 5. We are on page 1677. Mi gila pnei levusho. Bechefel risno mi yavo. So first we talk jaws. A little reference to the clothing first, which is the scales of the creature. Who has uncovered the clothing of the crocodile, of his Leviathan, meaning who has actually removed those scales? Bechefel risno mi yavo. Who is it who's going to come within range of kefel risno? A resen is a bit, like in the mouth of a horse. That's what a resen is. A double, and it's usually made of metal. It's like it's a piece of metal. So a doubled piece of metal in the mouth is a reference to the teeth of the Leviathan. Doubled because, you know, two jaws. So you have this double bit in its mouth, and nobody dares to come near those. Dalsei fanav mifiteach. The doors of its mouth, in other words, its lips, I should say, not its jaws, its lips. Who would dare open those lips? Sivos shinav ema. There is terror around its teeth. You don't mess with the mouth of a crocodile. The gun or no gun, frankly. Gava afikei maginim sagur chosam tsar. Gava, which is often rendered as arrogance, but it's simply might, it's strength. It could be arrogance also. Afikei meginim. The maginim, I should say, sorry. So the way that it's rendered in Dat Mikra is that in Afik, like Afikim Banegev, are channels through which water travels. They're like pipes. So what he says here regarding the scales on it is that the scales evoke gavai, sense of the might of the creature. Sagur chosam tsar. They are sealed tightly. They're closely sealed, meaning you can't get between beneath them. They're like these copper channels, and nothing is going to get. I don't know why I said copper in particular. But like the channels, and nothing can get between them. Echad be'echad yigashu. One knocks against the next. V'ruach lo yavo b'nehem. No space is between them. There is no vulnerability. Ish be'achihu yidubaku. One clings to its brother. Yislakdu velo yisparadu. They attach each one to the next. They're caught on the next. And they cannot be separated. There is no vulnerability there in its scales. So it has jaws, right, with pointy teeth. And it has these impregnable scales. And then we get to the hardest part of this creature, and the part that's most challenging if you want to explain that this is just a crocodile. And that's the fire-breathing aspect of it. Pasuk Yud, sentence 10. Atisho sav tahel or. When it sneezes, it radiates light. Oh. Ve'enav ke'avapei shachar. Its eyes are like the dawn. They radiate light. Mipiv lapidim yahalochu. From its mouth, flames go forth.
Right.
Yeah.
This is
it sounds like a dragon, no? Kidode eish yismalatu. And sparks of fire flee from its mouth. Minichirav yatsa yetse ashan. From its nostrils, smoke pours forth. Kidud nafuach ve'agmon. Like a dud. A dud is a kettle. A kettle, nafuach, that they've used a bellows to inflate the flames, v'agmon, and fed with reeds, like the agmon that we talked about before. Nafsho gechalim tilahet, it's nefesh, meaning its breath. Gechalim tilahet, burns with coals. V'lahav mipiv yetzei, and flames emerge from its mouth. So is this a fire-breathing creature? Well, if I take it as metaphorical entirely, so why not? Let's give it fire-breathing. Well, we're just, you know, adding to what it can do, pile it on. Mitzudat David, though, is very uncomfortable with this. Mitzudat David really does think that this is a crocodile or an alligator, and again, as I said last week, you know, when someone figures out which one lives where, we can figure out which one it is. But take a look at source number 5 and what he says to deal with this fire-breathing thing. He says, "Ahevel hayotzei mimenu be'eis ha'yitush tazriach or." Its exhalation when sneezing radiates light. Verotzel omar, meaning, kokach gavra bo chom hativi. Its natural heat, its internal heat, is so powerful. Ki'ilu haya malei esh. It's as though the beast were filled with flame. Uki'ilu yavrik v'yair be'is yotzia hevel. As though it would shine and illuminate when exhaling. V'im ki teva hadagim hukar. Even though fish are naturally cold. Meaning fish are cold-blooded. Right, that we know. There's no reason for a fish to have such a hot temperature inside. Are they truly amphibious? Right. So are they warm-blooded or cold-blooded? They're still cold-blooded. A cold-blooded creature means that it doesn't regulate its own temperature. Its temperature is based on its environment. So what he's saying is, this creature should not be this hot. And that's the statement that's being made, is that this is an unusual creature. It overpowers even the coldness of the water, and it's able to generate heat inside as though it was producing flame, but not that it's actually producing flame. That's the way that he wants to read it. In source number 6, similarly, he says, Meirov chom hativi yichumam hevel piv, because of its great natural heat, its breath is heated. Ki'ilu lapidei eish holchim mipiv, as though flames were leaving its mouth. O ki'ilu nitzotzot nishlachim mimenu, and as though sparks were being hurled from it.
So why doesn't he say that?
Why doesn't he say as though? Because nothing kills a good metaphor like saying as though.
So why doesn't he say it's a dragon?
Well, it can't be a dragon, because seriously, dragons fly. This thing isn't flying anywhere. We didn't tell you anything about flying. Have you never seen a dragon? It has wings.
We talked about a bird.
We did, but the bird was the playing image, not... No, no one said anything about it flying.
Pterodactyl.
It's a different kind of
bird. Pterodactyls fly. Not to mention Eo wouldn't have seen them. Unless he went to the museum. The,
Watched the movies.
Right, that's the other possibility. He's a big Jurassic Park fan, I think, you know. Yes. So, that alone was suffering enough. No, the,
Do you like the raptors?
So, yes, there's another possibility. The image here is either just sheer metaphor, part of the general overarching metaphor, or Mitsudatta, it is correct. This is a crocodile and is simply using hyperbole. Those are your basic options on this front. But he isn't done. Fire breathing wasn't enough. We go back to talk about the hide of the creature, not just the scales, but the hide itself being like armor. Pasuk Yud Dalet, sentence 14. Bitsavaru yalin oz. On its neck rests might, strength. Ulfanav tadutz de'ava, and sorrow and grief dance before him. Maple visaro daveku. The layers of its flesh. Maple is a term for layers. The layers of its flesh stick to each other. Yatsuk alav bal yimot. It's like they're molded on it, so that it won't collapse, it won't fall. Meaning that you can't, there's no vulnerability there. Libo yatsuk kemo aven. Even the belly of the creature, which you know, you think of the underbelly as soft and vulnerable, not on this one. Its belly is molten. Its belly is like stone. V'yatsuk kefelach tachtit. It is molded like felach tachtit, which Don Mikra says is the lower millstone. Remember the way that they milled, the way that they ground up grain, right? You had a lower stone which was massive, and it sat there on the ground. You didn't do anything with it. You put the grain on top of it, and then you have another stone over it, which you turn. But the lower stone, nothing's budging that lower stone. So that's the image that he uses for the belly of this Leviathan. Miseito, Pasuk Yitzayin, sentence 17. Miseito yaguru elim. Mighty people are afraid of its strength. Mishvarim yischatau. So the Dad Mikra takes mishvarim like mishberot, mishberei yam, which means waves, which makes sense because it is in the water. The waves themselves are frightened of him. Pasuk Yudchet, sentence 18. Masigeyu cherev beli takum. Somebody tries to attack it with a sword, he's not going to stand. Chanit masa v'shiriya. Various weapons of war that one might use to attack, different kinds of swords and arrows and lances, forget about it. Yachshov teven barzel. Iron? It's like straw to him. Le'etz rikavon nechusha. Nechusha, nechosha, copper is like rotting wood. You're not getting anywhere. Lo yavrichenu ven kashet. A person with a bow cannot scare it off. Lekashne pechulo avnei kala. The stones of the catapult, right? You want to try it from far away? Bop them on that from far away? It's like straw. Kikash nechshavu sosach. He says, like straw is considered the lance. V'yishak l'rash kidon. And it does what? It laughs at the noise of the spear. This is now, within God's speeches, the fifth time we've seen a creature laughing at human civilization. Right? We had the donkey laughing, we had the horse laughing, we had the ostrich laughed also. We had it before with behemoth. The animals that hang out with the behemoth laugh as well, although there it wasn't clear what they were laughing at. And here we see it laughing at this human warrior who thinks he's going to attack the Leviathan. Once again, this image of the wild part of the universe having no fear whatsoever of human civilization. This is territory you can't go in, Job. Sentence 22. Tachtav chadudei chares. Beneath it are shards of pottery, which the commentators suggest means rocks that are like pottery shards. Because remember, this is in the sea. not much in the way of pottery down there, but it's the idea that there are rocks in the bottom of the water. Yirpad charutz aleitit. The Leviathan lies down on them. The Resh Pei Dalet is a term we use for a bed sometimes, like in Shir HaShirim. Yirpad charutz aleitit. It lies on these sharp surfaces, just like it's lying on clay. It doesn't bother it. It lies on this sharp surface, and it's not disturbed. Yertiach kasir mitzula. Now he talks about the strength of the creature. He churns up the depths like a pot. Yam yasim kamerkacha. He turns the sea into a merkacha. Merkacha is a pharmacy. You blend things together. He makes the sea into a blend. Acharav ya'ir nasiv. After him, his path, meaning his wake, shines, right? You think of churning up the white, foam on it. Its wake shines. Yachshov tahom l'seva. It makes the depths like something like gray hair. Again, it's the churning of the sea. Ein al afar mashlo. There is nothing on land to be compared with this. He'asu livlichat. They translate he'asu like he'asui. It is made without fear. And finally, es kol gavoa yireh. Even though it's in the sea, nonetheless, it sees everything that is way high up. Hum melech al kol b'nei shachatz. It is the king of all the frightening creatures. Shachatz we've used before with animals in Perek Chavchet in chapter 28. The creatures who know no fear and are brazen. This one is the boldest of them all because there ain't no predator that's going to attack it. And whereas the image of the behemoth was explicitly vegetarian, right? We said it eats chatzir, it eats grass. We didn't actually get into the diet of the Leviathan. But I don't know about you, but I came away with a feeling of carnivore. This felt very carnivorous to me. Take a look at Mitzudat David. I didn't bring it on the sheet, sorry. But Mitzudat David is the one who points out that it sees everything that is that is high up. So he's given Job this image. Now, before we get to kind of a summary of this speech, I had to add another layer here, because you can't skip it. I already referred to it a little bit when I introduced the behemoth, which is the association between the Leviathan and Olam Haba, what happens in the next world. Take a look, please, at source number 7. Amar Rabba Amar Rabbi Yochanan, a passage out of the Talmud. Rabba quotes Rabbi Yochanan. He says, "Asid Hakadosh Baruch Hu laso seud al tzadikim mibesaro shel Leviathan." He says, "God is going to make a feast for the righteous out of the flesh of the Leviathan." Shenamar, he quotes you one of our verses, "Yichru alav chabarim." In the English, I just referred you to the verse that we have rather than retype a translation. But we just read it, so hopefully it's fresh in our minds. The verse said, "Yichru alav chabarim," which we said could mean the merchants getting together to set prices for it. So he reads it as "Vein kara ela seuda." He says, "No, kara." Chaf Reish Hay is a reference to a feast, and he gives you a verse from Malachim Bet, Kings 2, that uses the term in that context. Vein chaverim el talmidei chachamim, and the term chabarim, we're reading like chaverim, which is Torah scholars, and he gives you a reference to a verse in Song of Songs about chaverim, which he says refers to scholars. Vasha'ar, so that the scholars are getting a feast out of this Leviathan. Vasha'ar mechalkin oso, and the rest, they split up. Va'osim boschara b'shuke Yerushalayim, and they sell it in the streets of Jerusalem, in the markets, quoting the rest of that verse, Yechuol av chavarim yechitzu bein kananim. They will distribute it among the merchants. And Kanani, as we already know, and we said, is a tagar, is a merchant. Sorry? A socher, exactly. So what we see first is the idea of a feast with it, and then look at the next line. V'amar Rabba Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabba also said, quoting Rabbi Yochanan, God is very into the environment. He's not about to waste any aspect of the Leviathan. The hide also has a purpose. Presumably he can use the bones for musical instruments at the feast. It's a very native way to do it. So Rava says, according to Rabbi Yochanan, Asid HaKadosh Baruch Hu Laso Sukala Tzadikim Me'orosh HaLeviathan, God is going to make a hut, a shelter for the Tzadikim from the hide of the Leviathan. He quotes our verse, Hatmalei Basukot Oro. Remember I said to you, Rashi says, that means, would you make huts, shelters out of it? That's Rashi is getting that idea from the Gemara here. And if somebody merits, he gets a sukkah. If he doesn't merit, he'll just get silsal, that other word in the line from tzeil, shade. So you may not get a full hut, you may get a visor. It all depends on your level. Which we find the idea in elsewhere in the Talmud, also in Baba Batra, actually, I think. It speaks of the idea of each righteous person getting dwelling according to whatever they achieved in this world. So some get a hut and some get a visor. That's the way it goes.
But doesn't that remind you of Jonah?
Yes, well, that was what we had said before. This is the Jonah reference to the hut. It does remind me of it. I don't like it, but it does. But flip the page. See number 8. Ashkenazim may be familiar with this. By now, Sephardim may be familiar with it too, with the blending of customs. But Yeshanagu, some have the practice, Kishayu Yotzim min HaSukkah, when they leave the Sukkah, Hayu Omrim, they would say, Yiratzon Shniz Kalei Shev B'Sukkah Shalivyatan, may it be God's will, then we merit to sit in the hut of Leviathan. That's a reference to what we've been reading, and the idea that this beast has a purpose. The purpose of this beast is ultimately to reward the righteous in the future. Now, Maharal, remember, goes to town on all of this and says this is not literal, it's not meant to be literal, there isn't a feast, don't get your hopes up. The Maharal has insisted that it's all allegorical. Having said that, the Gemara in Chulin says that based on the verses in our chapter, you can see that Leviathan is a kosher creature. He reads it and shows you that you can see scales identified, and one of the references he also reads as fins. And so he says, see, it has fins and scales. Clearly, it's the Gemara says it's in Chulin, says that it's a kosher creature. But the one interesting thing, just in terms of if you want to get into the Jewish law aspect of it, is that he says, may we sit in the Sukkah Leviathan. Right? So some have the addition, slightly different, Shnei Shev L'Shana Haba'a, that next year we should be in the Sukkah of Leviathan. However, commentators on that say that's a mistake. The Aruch Liner, I think it's Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, made the statement that that can't be, because fish skin is not kosher for a sukkah. So therefore, it doesn't mean next Sukkot we want to be in a Leviathan Sukkah. It just means at some point, which is why the Rama didn't say it's on Sukkot. He just said, in general, in the future, we should merit to be in the hut of the Leviathan when Mashiach comes. But this image of Leviathan with associating it with Olam Haba, with this messianic time, is consistent with the idea that this is God's special creature. This isn't your run-of-the-mill crocodile sitting in the river. This is indeed something unique and special. If you take a look at source number 9, with Shavuos coming up, I couldn't resist. This is towards the end of the poem Akdamus, or Akdamut, I suppose. But it doesn't sound right as Akdamut. It's Akdamus. Akdamus is a poem which is recited before the Torah reading on the first day of Shavuos, before you're going to read about the presentation of the Torah at Sinai. And it's about the glory of Torah, the value of Torah, the study of Torah. And at the end, it moves into the reward for studying Torah. And here you see, I gave you a translation here. I think it's mine. I think I wrote the translation. But it was late at night, so I could be wrong. But no, I think this one's mine. The poem speaks of the Leviathan and the Behemot attacking each other. And here you see the association of Behemot with an ox, as opposed to a buffalo. As opposed to a hippopotamus. The idea of them battling each other and then God preparing this feast. First playing with the Leviathan, and then the game with the Leviathan. If you see the reference, the word in the Aramaic is telula. Chucha Utlula, our term for ridicule. So it's playing with Leviathan, and then it slaughters the Leviathan for this feast. I suppose that in this light, in light of the idea that Leviathan is some kind of reward for the future, you could put another spin on this whole speech, which I haven't seen anybody do, and say that God is actually saying to Job, yeah, I know you suffered, but there's reward in the future. That's what this Behemoth and Leviathan are. There's a reward in the future. I haven't seen anybody read it this way. On the other hand, I haven't exhausted all that there is to be said about Job. But I think it's an interesting possibility. But I bring it to you because you can't talk about Leviathan and Behemoth without knowing that we have within our tradition this whole other layer of what's going on with these creatures. Shana.
They also turn up in the pew for Rosh Hashanah and Mitzkoach. And there's a reference there to having the meal of eating the Leviathan.
Correct. For those who use Amitzkoach as their avodah on Yom Kippur, correct. Amitzkoach is the poem that tells about all of creation leading up to the time of the avodah, the temple service.
I'm still kicking and screaming at that concept of Nisim, that you're nothing and there's a world out there, and I read it to the whole thing as saying God has a whole world that you're not aware of. Not that you're secondary or not that you're nothing compared to the animals, just that God, just as he takes care of the animals, things that you can't even imagine, that even in the world to come, that you have no way of fathoming what God's reasons are.
Right. So I would say two things.
I find that concept, but I still find it very strange.
Okay.
Not because...
I'll say two things. Number one is that it's not Nusim, it's the Rambam. Nusim came a little bit later. That human beings are just not the point of the universe, and that not the point of the universe, aren't involved with it. No, we do our thing, and there are many other things. Leonardo, I'll send you the Rambam so you can take a look at it. But he's very, very clear on this idea. So that's one point that I think is important to know. But second, I think you're right. I think you could read this. I think you could read this as saying simply you don't understand without saying you're not the point. You could read it that way. That's fair. To sum up what we've done in this second speech, God has once again established the clear gap between his world and Job's world, whether we read it as gap in terms of control and comprehension or more than that. More, God has established that man's order and civilization are limited. And here I reference you to Nusim in source number 10, with the line that I referred to already earlier. The human passion for moral order is also a passion for security. Right? We want order in part because we want to be safe. For discerning a way of living that can keep the world whole and children safe. Going back to the beginning of the book. And Job would rise early in the morning and would offer whole offerings according to the number of them all, of all his kids. For Job said, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God. Right? That was what we read straight out of the beginning of the book. It is a passion to deny the tragic in existence. To deny the possibility that there's something beyond our control that doesn't listen to what we say and that can destroy at a whim. The face of Leviathan exposes the hubris and the self-deception of the human rage for order. When you see a creature which, the modern equivalent is the terrorist attack. That's really what it is. It's the attack which doesn't have any rules, which can't be stopped by your police and your militaries, and is going to disrupt and kill and do whatever it's going to do, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. That's really what this is saying. There was one other question that I wanted to address, and that I didn't really have a good answer for it anyway, so I don't mind that it's coming at the end. But I at least have to ask it. Sharon asked it at the end last week, which is, why in these speeches does God not address Job with compassion? Meaning, it's just a straight lecture. You don't understand Job. You can't understand Job. There's this whole other world out there that you just don't get. How about, sorry... Or how about, if not sorry, at least, yes, Job, you've been a good person. It's going to come a little bit in chapter 42. But his first two speeches to Job are just, lecture. What is this? So one possibility in my mind, and I'm going to leave it with this, is that this is really a book of yirah, not ahava. It's a book of reverence for God, loyalty to the King and Creator. It's not a book of love. And that goes back to our discussion about Job versus Song of Songs. It says there can be no close relationship. And so all we get out of God, including in 42, frankly, is God as a logical speaker conveying a direct answer rather than speaking softly and nicely and making Job feel better. I think there's a lot more that has to be said about this, but that's just my thought from a week of thinking about the question. And it's something that's probably worth discussing next week and or during the week of the Siyum, which will, God willing, be the day after Shavuos. Thank you very much.